You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, a weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. This is episode number 73. What matters most? Scientific advice, roleplay on estimates, a replay from the PSI conference in 2018. We have an upcoming webinar on leadership because lots of what you will listen to during this episode requires a lot of leadership. It requires influencing, negotiating, communicating, building relationship, building trust, all these different things. And if you want to be successful at it, you need to have these leadership skills. So our webinar will be one piece in the puzzle to bring you closer to becoming an effective leader, an effective statistician. You can sign up for this webinar at theeffectivestatistician.com/leadershipwebinar. Just go there, sign up, tell your colleagues about it, and I'll see you soon at this webinar. It will be pretty awesome. So, in today's episode, we are just giving you a replay from a really, really, really nice session that I participated in the 2018 PSI conference. If you have been there on the Wednesday morning, it was really, really awesome. It was lots of fun, lots of really, really, really nice insights as we tackled this estimates problem from a regulatory perspective, from a patient perspective, from an HTA perspective, and from a sponsor perspective. And through this discussion, you get a much better kind of point of view of why it's so difficult to come up with an estimate that satisfies everybody. Maybe it's actually impossible. And that's actually a valid point in having different estimates for different stakeholders. So stay tuned. We have really, really nice people on the show, and I'm pretty sure you'll like it. This episode, this podcast, is created in association with PSI, a global member organization dedicated to leading and promoting best practice and industry initiatives. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the video on demand content library, where this is also sitting, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. The reduced rate is just £20 per year for non-high income countries and only £95 for high income countries. Visit the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today.
So thank you for joining our session today with the title, What Matters Most? Scientific Advice Roleplay. But I think this is not like the usual normal session, and therefore I think it deserves a different sort of title slide to actually kick this all off. So as you all know, this is all within the larger production of the PSI conference. And the scene that we will be focusing on here today is a scene where a sponsor is actually seeking joint scientific advice from a regulatory agency and from an HTA body. So my name is Mona. For those of you who don't know me, I'm one of the directors. I also have co-directors, of course, Rachel and Anna. And we will be using a very special camera today to enhance the clarity and visibility of this whole topic, which is called ICH-E9R1. And yeah, so this is essentially the scene that we will be focusing on. And of course, we have a great cast for this. So first of all, we have David Wright, who is representative for the regulatory agency of the Netherlands. Then we have Alexander Schacht, who is representative for the HEA agency of Wonderland. Then we also have a sponsor, or a representative from a sponsor, Oliver Keen, who's working for Patient First. And finally, of course, we know that as the title is What Matters Most to Patients, we also need a patient, right? So we do have a patient, Steven Ruberg, who is suffering from COPD. So the scene that we will be looking at is really in COPD. And we will be looking at what is the treatment effect measure, if you want, or estimate, let's say, within this framework that is most relevant for these different parties. And the aim is not to come to a consensus. So we have like a short discussion, right? So the aim is not to come necessarily to a consensus, but to show you a couple of the discussion points and interesting aspect that may come up in such discussions. And of course, you are not only here to be like seated there and watching it, but you will also get the opportunity to actually participate in this. So towards the end, we'll leave like 10, 15 minutes so that you can contribute to the scene yourself. So without saying much more, I would then hand over to the patient so he can maybe first of all give us his perspective, and then we sort of go into this natural joint scientific advice type of setup. So over to you, Steve.
Good morning, and thank you for inviting me to this dialogue. First, I want to note that I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. I'm a patient with COPD. I want to tell you what it's like. I want to tell you what I want, what concerns me, and what's important to me so that you can do better research. Do you know what it's like when you cannot breathe? Maybe you were underwater once and running out of breath. The only thing you can think about is getting to the surface so you can take your next breath. Did you panic? Were you frightened? That's what I face each day, that I might go underwater and not be able to get to the surface. That's what frightens me most, and it's always there on my mind. I fear hospitalization. I get scared when I have what they call an exacerbation. I'm sure you've all had the experience of being out of breath. Perhaps you had to run or to climb a lot of steps quickly. You know how you take deep breaths, your chest heaving to get as much air as possible. What if you could not get enough breath, no matter how hard you tried to inhale? What if you constantly felt a little out of breath, that each breath was an effort, that each breath was not automatic, but maybe a semi-conscious or even conscious effort to expand your lungs and pull in as much air every time with every breath? I hate shortness of breath. I hate that I cannot do what I want to do because of it. I hate it because it's always with me. My doctor says I have to improve my FEV1 and my dyspnea score. He says that the key to my quality of life is to adhere to my medications. Believe me, I adhere to my medications, all three of them, every day, even though it's wearisome, since they are my lifeline, my rescue, my way of life. I hear you're working on a new injectable medication, and I do not mind the idea of infrequent injections. But here's what I want from a drug in the following order of importance. Number one, I want this new drug to be more effective at helping me breathe. If I take this medication, will I go to the hospital less? Will I be able to do more physical activities and for longer times? Is it possible that this new medication might be a cure for me? Number two, what are the chances of having a side effect? And what are the side effects I should know about? I know there will be some side effects, but unless they are disastrous or catastrophic, I will work through them with my doctor, or we can decide to give up and try a new medication. If I can breathe better, do more, feel more comfortable, I will figure out the side effects, again, unless they are really, really bad. I've tried new medications before that have not worked, and I want to get off of them as soon as possible. Sometimes my doctor says I must stick with the new medications to give them a chance to work. Well, that's easy to say, but when you are underwater or your chest is heaving, you do not want to wait very long to see if the new medication helps. So if this new medication doesn't work, how long will I have to take it for me or my doctor to know? Rest assured, this is huge on my mind. I have tried new medications that work initially yet seem to lose their effect over time. Number four, I'm appreciative of the benefits, but sometimes I wonder if it's worth it. If the benefit persists long enough, then okay. If the benefit wanes quickly, then I might as well have never started on such a new treatment. Number five, I want to get off my other medications. Can you simplify my life, make it easier to control my disease? If I continue to take this new medication, will I be able to take fewer medications or use less of my existing medications? This is important to me, and cheaper too. Number 6, how does this injection work? If I take this new medication for the rest of my life, do I do it? Do I have to come to the doctor's office to get it done? Is it a quick injection or a longer infusion? Does the injection hurt? And number 7, I'm worried about the cost of such a new medication. I understand that's a separate issue for some of you, but since you ask what's important to me, there it is, cost. Please help develop more effective treatments for COPD. Please give me and my doctor the answers to the concerns and questions that I have just enumerated. Before I change my meds or add a new med, I want to know as much as possible about what happens when I take it. I do not want to end up in the hospital emergency room. I do not want to drown. Thank you.
Thank you very much for giving us that patient perspective. It's very relevant, and I'm sure that the sponsor as well as the regulator and the HTA body will take that into account in their discussion. So with that, I think our sponsor would like to give us his presentation on what drug they are developing. Could we have the patient first slide?
Well, while the slides are coming up, first of all, I'd like to thank the agency and the HTA for the opportunity to come along and talk to us about our new medication from Patient First Pharmaceuticals. And a particular thanks to Steve for outlining the issues a patient has and what matters most to him. The new treatment we've got is a biological treatment for COPD. It's called IL-99. As you know, we submitted a briefing document to you, and I think we have agreement on the dose that we're going to use, which will be 1 milligram by injection every 4 weeks. And we have agreement on the endpoints. The primary endpoint of the studies will be exacerbations, which are defined as a worsening of COPD symptoms that require oral steroids or antibiotics. We also have agreement on a quality of life measure as a secondary endpoint, a fairly standard one, SGRQ, that's a standard quality of life measurement in this area. The topic for today's discussion is the estimand for the two pivotal trials, 506-2018 and 506-2019, identical trials. And specifically, what we'd like to seek your advice on is the strategy for intercurrent events. So to move on to trial 506-2018 in severe COPD, the objective is to compare the efficacy and safety of our new IL-99 biological treatment versus placebo, a superiority study. It's going to be a 52-week phase 3 study, double-blind parallel group. What's important to understand here is this is on top of standard of care therapy, so subjects will maintain what they're currently taking. We will have planned follow-up of off-treatment for subjects who prematurely discontinue their randomized treatment. But even with that, we do expect that some subjects will fail to complete the study. So as I said, the inclusion criteria is to be on maximal standard of care therapy. So that, in this case, is triple therapy with a long-acting bronchodilator, an inhaled corticosteroid, and a long-acting muscarinic treatment. And they must have been using this triple therapy for at least a year. To get into the trial, they must be not completely controlled on this triple therapy. So they must have had at least one exacerbation in the previous year. So the triple therapy is not eliminating all of their exacerbations. The population, to go through the classic parts of the estimand framework, the population is defined by those inclusion-exclusion criteria, which I've just gone through. The primary variable will be the number of exacerbations the patient experiences. And we will compare that between treatments by the rate of exacerbations, the ratio of the rates of exacerbations on IL-99 compared to placebo. Secondary variable will be the quality of life, as measured by the SGRQ instrument. And we will average that over the average the SGRQ score over the time points in the study. And the key intercurrent event that we'd like to seek your advice on is treatment discontinuation. So what we're expecting on the placebo treatment I put up there in terms of treatment discontinuation, we're expecting that around 20% of patients in the study will discontinue their randomized medication, well, their placebo medication. This is based on our previous trials in this area and our previous experience in COPD. We're expecting around 2% to die, other adverse events around 9%, a lack of efficacy about 2%, very low, given as a primary reason. And a number of subjects, a significant number, will simply choose to withdraw because they don't want to be part of a clinical trial. And the reason they give is the burden of study procedures. What we're expecting with our new drug is to have similar discontinuations due to adverse event, but overall fewer discontinuations. And the only adverse event that we're expecting, that we anticipate to be of a higher frequency in the active arm compared to the placebo arm, is injection site reactions. These are generally mild in nature and don't cause a patient to discontinue from the studies. So what's our proposed strategy for treatment discontinuation? Well, what we're proposing is strategy 5 in the ICHE9 document, the while on treatment strategy. We'll supplement this with an analysis of the frequency and the reason for treatment discontinuation. As we've heard, it's very important to the patient to know whether they're going to discontinue due to an adverse event, whether they'll discontinue due to lack of efficacy. We will include these analyses in our package. But the primary analysis will be a while on treatment we're proposing, will be a while on treatment strategy for discontinuation. And what's the rationale for that? Well, in our view, and we are patient-first pharmaceuticals after all, our view is that this will be the most informative to the prescriber and patient. A patient who sees an estimate in a clinical trial, an estimated treatment effect, my view is they don't realise that that's actually, if you use a treatment policy strategy, that would be an average of taking the treatment and not taking the treatment. I think what's most informative to a patient is what actually happens when they take the treatment, and that's what they're most interested in knowing. Another issue that complicates a treatment policy type strategy for this particular situation is that once they discontinue, if they discontinue treatment, their doctors may put them on to an alternative medication. And in particular, I know a pharmaceutical company called GSK is currently developing a biological, which I'm told is extremely effective. So the worry is that people will take these alternative medications, and that will dilute the efficacy of our drug. It won't fairly reflect the efficacy of the IL-99 treatment. Finally, and most importantly, as you know, you're making a judgment on benefit-risk of medicines. And we believe, in order to make a fair assessment of that, the estimand for efficacy and the estimand for safety should be done under the same principles. So for safety, we're proposing a very standard approach to safety, which is a while on treatment. We're going to summarise adverse events while the patient is actually taking the medication. So it seems to ask for a fair assessment of benefit, we should do a while on treatment assessment of efficacy. Then we're matching the two strategies. Obviously, we will look at adverse events that occur after people have finished the treatment. But to us, the key assessment of benefit risk should be while on treatment for efficacy and while on treatment for safety. So I'd welcome your comments on our proposal.
Okay, thank you very much, Oliver. So just a formal welcome to everyone here, the new home of the European Medicines Agency. I hope you agree that it's nearly as nice a location in Canary Wharf. The gold taps in the bathroom are particularly nice. But thank you for your presentation, and also a warm welcome to Steve as the patient. If you've got any questions throughout the discussion, please do stop me, because patients are, of course, central to everything we do here at CHMP, so just like to make that point. So don't feel if you want to interrupt, please do. So thanks for the presentation. I've just got a few clarifications, if I may. In terms of the briefing book, it is rather large, Oliver. If you could sort of manage it a bit better next time, it would be appreciated. There is limited time for preparation for these meetings, and it is a bit of a struggle. So if you could could work on your team on that, it would be appreciated.
Well, thanks for the comments. There are some agencies who do review it in a lot of detail.
Thank you for that. And, and as you know, there are other drugs in development in this area for other companies. But anyway, on to the matter in hand. So just to clarify the aim of this treatment, obviously you're talking about a fairly severe COPD population, and you're interested... I'm just clarifying what you would like in your label. So is this going to be a long-term treatment for COPD, or do you imagine most patients will only take one or two injections? It would help me in deciding which Estiman makes most sense, if you could clarify that for me.
Sure. That's a good question. We're not expecting that this medication will be disease-modifying. So we're seeing this as a chronic treatment for COPD.
Okay, thank you. Now, moving on to your choice. So I agree with you in terms of your decision to discount treatment policy as a suitable estimand. I can see that with all the other things going on in this arena, it would complicate matters in the evaluation of the efficacy of your drug. So I agree with that. But you'd only briefly described the possibility of hypothetical, and you just say that it requires extrapolation beyond the data that is observed. That doesn't necessarily make it a bad idea to me. I wonder if you could give that. What did you consider in terms of hypothetical estimands?
Yes, we looked at the issue of hypothetical estimands very closely. Clearly, that's another option that we could have proposed. What worries us about a hypothetical estimand is the nature of, it's in the label. It's a hypothetical thing that would have happened if patients had continued to take the treatment. What we want to describe is what actually happens while they do take the treatment. So there's no extrapolation into unobserved data. There's no need for these fancy statistical methods that our statistician keeps proposing to me.
But what about alternative hypothetical strategies that don't do that? Ones that, for example, if when Steve stops taking his medication, we could model what would have happened if he didn't take other medications. Obviously, you know in real life that he would do, and that would cloud the evaluation of the efficacy of your drug. But instead, trying to model what would have happened if they weren't on additional therapies. Did you consider that option?
Yes, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, I haven't outlined here our complete statistical strategy. And of course, we would seek to do alternative estimands, supplementary estimands, as well as the primary estimand, which we're proposing as well on treatment. The approach you're outlining is very sensible. We would agree that we would include that as one of the supplementary estimands in the package. As I said, though, the concern there is, as you said, you have to make assumptions about what would happen to these patients if they hadn't taken the medication, the alternative medication. So there are assumptions there that we have to build in. We would have to build in sensitivity analyses to those assumptions. We have to model it. And that worries us somewhat in putting that forward as the primary estimand strategy.
Okay, thank you. And then just to help me understand the while on treatment strategy in terms of how you estimate this estimand, just wondered if you could clarify. So if, for example, Steve takes the medication once and has no exacerbations in that month, but then there's another patient that takes it for a whole year and doesn't have any exacerbations. How is that handled in the analysis that you would propose for this estimand?
Yes, we're using a negative binomial. We're proposing a negative binomial approach for the analysis of exacerbations. Within that analysis, there's a feature of that analysis that you model the variation of patients across patients as well as within patients. So you don't count a patient who's been studied for 12 months. They don't get 12 times the weight of a patient who's only accounted for 1 month. So that will be accounted for in the analysis.
Okay. And then, so, but in terms of all these treatment discontinuations, then, so if, similarly, if somebody discontinues due to an adverse event, they would be treated exactly the same way as someone who'd discontinued due to the burden of the study in the analysis. Is that true?
That's correct, because the nature of a while on treatment estimand is to summarise the experience of the patient while they're taking the treatment. We believe that's the most important thing to the patient and the prescriber. I think the key feature of this medication and what we're expecting from previous trials is that the percentage of patients who discontinue due to adverse event, we think, will, if anything, will be lower on the active medication, and similarly for the percentage of patients who discontinue due to lack of efficacy. I think an important supplementary analysis of these trials is going to be to compare the percentage of patients who discontinue due to lack of efficacy and the percentage of patients who discontinue due to adverse event. We believe that's an important piece of information for the patient.
Mm-hmm. But do you agree that the ones who withdraw due to the burden of the study, I mean, we don't know anything about them in terms of whether there is a good or bad reason. It could really have been due to the study.
Yes.
Some of those patients, undoubtedly, it might not have been, but we just don't know. Whereas the other ones, we actually do know it was a bad thing that happened. So it seems strange to treat them the same.
Yeah, I mean, to go back to your point, I mean, we would agree there is this ambiguity around reason for withdrawal and, you know, how reliable is the information that we're collecting. We as a sponsor will work very hard to make sure that those reasons actually reflect the patient experience. We have found in our experience, because of regulatory requirements, we have to put collect a lot of data in our clinical trials. For reimbursement purposes, we have to include several questionnaires. And we find that a lot of patients find these burdensome. They don't want to come in and complete all of these questionnaires. That's the reason that they're giving to us for wanting to discontinue the trials. And we actually find in the real world, when we do real world studies, that we actually get fewer discontinuations in our real-world studies than we do in our clinical trials, where there are not so burdensome clinical trial procedures. So we do believe that the reason that the patient is telling us that they're discontinuing the treatment due to the burden of the trial. So I believe our view is that we have to believe the patient.
Well, so you want to say is that due to the requirements of the HDA bodies, your studies become so complex that you have so many discontinuations? I would disagree with that.
Well, I wasn't quite right.
And by the way, I thought that the dossier was actually not big enough. I think there were 20,000 tables missing, especially all the subgroup analysis. But So for me, I think I strongly disagree with the while on treatment approach, because I think when it's come to reimbursement, I take the efficacy and safety of a drug as a given, and then for me what's important and for society what's important is what happens to the overall population in this chronic disease over a long time. Yeah. So how does the new medication that enters into the market, how does it overall change the health of the population? And so for that reason, a treatment policy strategy is what I would like to see. You have a 52-week study, so that is reasonably long enough to say something about the long-term effects. Of course, something like a 5-year study would be better, but, well, we take that. So in terms of the endpoints, all the endpoints that you mentioned are patient-relevant, so that's good. And I also like your approach in terms of looking into the
basically the area under the curve over time. So what's the burden of the disease over time? But I think that is comes back to the treatment policy. I would like to understand how your new medication kind of changes the burden of the patient over a year. And I think that is important from a what. So what is the change in the benefit risk profile over this time period? So as I need to make, in the end, a summary in terms of the benefits and the risks of this new kind of when this treatment enters the market, how does it change? I would need to see kind of the treatment policy as demand for both the efficacy and for the safety to make an overall conclusion on this as demand or kind of benefit risk as demand perspective. For that reason, I think you need to be have a good plan for how you follow up patients after they stop the medication due to adverse event and efficacy or lack of efficacy. I can understand that you can't follow up after they died. That's okay. And I think for the withdrawals, I think you need to come up with some reasonable assumptions of what happens thereafter to kind of show how the benefit-risk profile across the 1 year comes. And with that, of course, kind of aside from those that died, you also have then for each patient the complete year, which makes, of course, some of the analysis things easier.
Well, thank you for those comments. One piece, if I could just ask you about what as we as a company are struggling with. Obviously, as a reimbursement agency, if the patient is not taking the treatment, you wouldn't be paying for it. So there would be no payment involved. So I'm struggling to quite understand why you're so eager for us to use a treatment policy strategy, whereas I thought you'd be most interested in what actually happens when the patient is actually receiving the treatment, because that's when you're actually having to reimburse the treatment.
Well, you know, we need to reimburse the treatment anyway over the 1 year. Whether it's your treatment or whether it's a different treatment, we need to reimburse it anyway. So I'm interested in Wonderland, we are more kind of on the medical focus, and currently that's the medical focus. The cost is discussed in the next step. So in this step, we only talk about the benefit risk. So, and the cost is actually then discussed behind the scenes at a different. So from that point of view, it's really important for me to understand how your treatment actually changes the overall health of the population, and that's the important thing. In terms of, you know, your comment regarding this seems to be a really super efficacious GSK drug, why didn't you consider to run a head-to-head study against it? But maybe that's another point.
Well, the difficulty with the, you raise a good point in terms of the alternative medication that's available. It's not actually approved yet. That's only there are publications out there in the public domain. Obviously, when we start the trial, the medication may not be available. This will only come onto the market and start to be used as the trial progresses. So that's where our concerns come from that point of view.
But are other treatments available?
There are currently no other biological treatments available for...
But other treatments?
Yes, there are other treatments, and that's the virtue of what we're doing, in the sense that we're offering the patients maximal standard of care, and that's where the comparison is. The comparison is of our drug plus maximal standard of care against placebo plus maximal standard of care. Maximal standard of care that's available at the moment is triple therapy. And that's what concerns me about what I'm struggling with your comments around we would have to reimburse anyway. That's true. The only extra reimbursement is for the IL-99. It's not like they're going to go on to, if they stop the IL-99, they will only only going to proceed, or the GSK drug if it's available.
But we're not talking about cost here. We're talking about the overall benefit-risk population thing. So
I think the patient wants to.
In Wonderland, you know, we have a overall health, very good health system, so patients don't need to care so much about the cost for themselves. It's more kind of a societal issue.
I will say that as a patient that's a candidate for this clinical trial, I've tried lots of other things, and I'm on these three medications now. These are what have worked the best for me, and I've tried all the other alternatives, and I'm down to nothing other than perhaps an experimental medication. So if this drug doesn't work for me in this trial, or if it ever got approved, I would discontinue it, but I would be at the end of my rope. I would just continue on my three medications. So there aren't a lot of other alternatives for me at the end of the disease line that I am at this point in time.
But what happens if you kind of, you know, if you take this medication for just 1 month, and then you, after that, you can't go back to your usual treatment. So you can't even, you know, even your treatment that now maybe not optimally work, but then is even worse working, not working at all anymore. And you need to be continuously hospitalized due to that.
Yeah, so I have tried other medications on top of the three that I'm taking, and when they don't work, I want to know as quickly as possible. And if I can know in 1 month after one injection whether this is going to work or not, that would be great, because I could make my decision with my doctor quickly. If this drug were so deleterious that it caused my other existing treatments to be ineffective, I would hope that you wouldn't improve this drug, or it would be only approved with very serious very significant benefits for those who didn't have that problem. But I would really want to know that at the time my doctor prescribed it, so that I could make an informed decision that you might get a lot of benefit, or if you don't, this could actually reduce the effect of your other treatments. Those would be important. Well, I'm not trained in statistics, but I think you used the word estimands.
Well, maybe I can reassure you on that point that the regulators would ensure that the benefit risk was appropriately evaluated, and so that I wouldn't agree with the approach taken on my right to evaluate the benefit of the drug in question. Obviously, I know you have a different.
Yeah, viewpoint. I'm not because evaluating the benefit of the drug. I'm evaluating
So once they've got past that hurdle, then obviously there are other hurdles that need to be gone through, which is a different matter.
Mm. So can we come back to just the question you raised about a treatment policy estimate for risk? That's somewhat unusual in the reporting of clinical trials. We haven't as a company seen that done elsewhere. Is this a sort of new policy from the reimbursement agencies? Because traditionally, safety is always assessed when you're actually taking the medication. So to view a treatment policy kind of approach, that might actually underestimate any potential safety signals that we would see in the trial. So that worries us as a sponsor company.
Well, as I said, I think to assess the safety of the drug itself is not my job. That's his job. So I'm interested in the overall safety of the population within this year. And if kind of, you know, if all your patients discontinue after 1 month and they have no side effects in this 1 month, but because they take it, they have continue side effects for the rest of the 11 months, for the rest of the year, I think these side effects, you know, overall the population is worse off due to the new treatment being available in the market.
I mean, you know, I think that will be part of our safety evaluation, as I said, although the primary evaluation will be of events that happen on treatment. We will, of course, look very closely as a sponsor at events that occur once a patient has discontinued it. But it would be very surprising to us to see any events in that period, going by precedent. So we do struggle with this idea of a treatment policy approach for safety, because that could, you know, if there is a signal in terms of the adverse event profile, we would expect to see that while the patient is taking the treatment, not in the post-treatment period.
By the way, for me, it doesn't matter whether you call it primary or secondary. You can have primary for him, and, you know, I take a secondary one.
And, of course, you know, as we know, for reimbursement agencies, we end up doing exactly what you want anyway, so that's...
Could I just raise one more issue? We're in a wonderful future now where the FDA publishes the analysis plans of the competitors. So you're aware that GSK are adopting a different strategy to this in their development plan. So how do you think us as a regulator, how are we going to cope with that when if we approve that your drug using this estimand and then somebody else in the same class uses a different approach? How do you think we're going to handle that situation?
Mm. I mean, you raise a very interesting question about how statistical methods evolve over time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very good point. You know, we are now in a situation where a lot of the old labels for a lot of the old drugs are based on estimates of treatment effect that use statistical methods that would now be seen as not optimal, shall we put that, give a different view on the efficacy of the drugs. So some of the early labels in this field for the older drugs might have used that outdated form of analysis called LOCF, for example. But I would be surprised if a regulator would now ask us to do an LOCF analysis just to match what had been done in the past. So I think we have to realise science evolves, statistical science also evolves, and we should use at any point the best methods available to us at the time. Another example would be in the clinical arena. If there was an old method of measuring blood pressure, so it was a blood pressure medication, and somebody had been labelled on the effects of that old method, and a new clinical method came along, which was a better way of expressing blood pressure, there wouldn't be a regulatory requirement to use the old method simply because somebody had been labelled using the old method. So we believe we should use the best science that's available to us at the moment.
No, I agree with that. It's just the fact that, I mean, GSK came last week and that's when we approved their approach. So so I don't think it's moved that much in the week. But
I think maybe some of the GSK statisticians are a bit outdated. Yeah.
So in terms of, that brings up a very important point, kind of, if you compare across different drugs, yeah, I think one of the nice things about the treatment policy is also that it's very, very easy to compare, because you always compare the 1 year across the different drugs. Whereas if you have this while on treatment strategy, you for one drug that has maybe, you know, an average exposure of 6 months and the other has 9 months, you compare, you know, completely different things. You don't, you know, isn't it much more better to kind of have a same kind of basis in terms of what you compare?
Well, actually, I'd entirely agree with you that we should try and have the same basis for comparisons. But as a sponsor, our view is actually you get a much fairer comparison if you're talking about while on treatment as an estimate.
Well, what's fair is... Hear me out.
The treatment policy approach will depend on the pattern of treatment discontinuations in that specific trial. So it only applies if you have to assume that in the real world or when a patient takes it, the pattern of discontinuations that you observe in that specific trial is reflected when people actually take it. And that might be dependent on what countries, what regions you run your trial in. Whereas a while on treatment one will be more stable in that sense, because it's reflecting what actually happens when the patients are actually taking the treatment. And in that sense, as a sponsor, we view that as a more accurate comparison.
Thank you very much for that interesting discussion. You will get the opportunity to have some final remarks to maybe conclude some of these open thoughts that you have, but I would like to give the opportunity to the audience to actually ask questions to either our regulatory colleague, HTA colleague, the patient, or even the sponsor. Any questions or comments from the audience on anything that you have heard so far?
I noticed that you proposed two identical studies. Is this simply to satisfy the needs of FDA and EMA in their guidelines that we ask for two studies, or do you not understand that we actually ask for a sequential approach where you could adapt your second study to the findings of the first study, and that should be some kind of confirmatory setting?
I guess that's a question to the sponsor. As patient-first pharmaceuticals, we are very concerned about the suffering of patients with COPD. And it's very important to us that if we have developed a new medication, that we get this medication to patients as soon as we can. The approach you're outlining would mean a substantial delay in getting this important new medication to the patients, because we would have to run our two confirmatory trials sequentially. That would delay approval, and it would delay a patient like Steve actually receiving that medication. So to us, as patient-first pharmaceuticals, we want to run our two pivotal trials in parallel.
Thank you. Any additional questions or comments? You have one over here in the middle.
Can we learn what the GSK solution to this problem has been? Or you referred that the GSK approach was different to the one being proposed. Can we know more about that?
GSK have got two proposals, because the FDA made them do treatment policy, and the EMA then said that they would prefer some hypothetical strategy. The one that I alluded to, where patients who withdraw, and then there's some sort of placebo imputation for them. Mm. So that was the alternative approach that may be a possibility here. Mm.
Thank you. Any additional questions or comments from the audience? We have one on the back.
Again, for the sponsor, you're proposing a while-on treatment approach. Could you clarify whether you're taking the time on treatment into account in that? I think there are two versions of that approach. One where if you're longer on treatment, you have a better score, like an AUC, and the other where you take a kind of an average. That's the clarification. I have a question following.
Yes, I mean it is a good question, and then we're getting into the sort of the estimation side of it. For the exacerbation rate, it does take into account, as I said earlier in the negative binomial, it does take into account the length of follow-up that a patient has been followed up for exacerbations. So that is accounted for in the analysis. In terms of the quality of life endpoint, you can view an AUC essentially as if you divide an AUC by the time. An AUC essentially gives you a weighted mean of time points. We prefer the kind of simplest solution of an average across the time points for the SGRQ measurement. And in that analysis, it would be in terms of the estimator, whether you weighted every patient equally, or then if you added extra weight to patients who'd been followed for longer. Those are perhaps... One would be a primary analysis, and perhaps one would be a sensitivity analysis for that particular estimand.
I have to ask for further clarification, I'm afraid. You say that the time observed will be taken into account in the negative binomial. How exactly would it be taken into account? Would you be having an offset or in your model or not?
Yes, I mean, to get into the technical details, yeah, it's the time on treatment in the generalized linear model you can put as an offset variable, and obviously your outcome variable is the number of exacerbations.
So this is a kind of an hypothetical estimand then, I would think.
No, I don't. I think it's interesting. I mean, it's an interesting point in terms of... the analysis of exacerbations, but essentially what you're doing is summarizing the while on treatment measurements rather than extrapolating outside of the observed period. So my view is that it's actually an estimator for a while on treatment estimand rather than for a hypothetical. You can then make the extrapolation assumption that if the rate was the same for the periods that you haven't observed, you could then translate that into a hypothetical estimand. But what you're doing then is adding that extra step of extrapolating to the unobserved periods, and then it would become a hypothetical estimand.
Thank you. I think we have another question. We have two questions over here, so maybe we... In the front. And then we go to the left. Evgeny?
A question to the HTA representative. I'm struggling to understand this treatment policy approach and the remark that you need to reimburse treatments for 1 year anyway, because after the discontinuation, patients may start new investigational drugs that you will never reimburse, like this GSK drug if it fails, for instance. So shouldn't you actually distinguish between therapies, post-treatment therapies that are on the market and those that are still investigational that you may never reimburse in future?
So, of course, only a very small fraction of the overall COPD population will be in a clinical trial. That might be different for actually certain other indications, but for in generally, we only look into medications that are approved. We only look into approved medication because also the new now experimental drug, by the time we look at it, will be approved or should be approved. Otherwise, we don't need to look at it. So any kind of follow-up experimental things don't fall into kind of my remit anyway.
Thank you for that. I have another question, and then we move to Anya.
Mark? So a question to the sponsor around the while on treatment strategy. My understanding around these drugs is limited, but as I understand it, it takes a while for them to start working, and late effects or side effects could also manifest a while after you may have stopped the drug. So are you worried that, for example, a patient might observe the drug is not working, stops taking the drug, and only then has an exacerbation, or similarly with adverse events? Are you worried that these could be missed because the patient first stops and then the event is reported?
Yeah, I mean it's an interesting question. Perhaps we could bring the patient in at some point. obviously it is a concern the drug will have to have a chance to work. I think, given the chronic nature of the disease, most patients would expect to take the medication for a certain period of time. We expect that certainly within a month or 2 months, for the patients for whom the drug is working, they will start to see an effect. That's what we hope. Regarding delayed side effects, as I said, we're not anticipating that this drug will cause many side effects anyway, but of course we will look very closely at the post-treatment data that we collect. We have agreements with the regulatory authorities in terms of how long to follow up patients, even those who complete the course of randomized treatment, in terms of looking at adverse events following discontinuation treatment. That will be part of our safety package. We will look at that very thoroughly. But we're not anticipating that there will be any safety signals once a patient discontinues the medication.
Thank you, Oliver. I have another question by Anya.
Yeah, I would like to ask the one person that we haven't heard that much, the patient. Taking your list 1 to 5, yeah. A, do you think that the study will address anything of relevance for you? And B, having heard the discussion, are you any wiser? Do you think that any of them is actually taking your major concerns into account?
Thank you for the question. First, I think you all need to be committed to an asylum for this. Oh, no, I'm... I'll tell you what matters to me in plain English words. When I take this treatment, what can I expect will happen to me? If there is some latent adverse event effect or some rebound effect of withdrawal from the medication, I want to know that, because that's what happens to me when I take this medication or when I stop taking this medication. So That's what I want to know. If it doesn't work for me, if I have an adverse event, what happens next is between me and my doctor and our choice of other medications and how I manage my life and my disease. But I would like as clear and concisely as possible, when I take this medication, what can I expect if I continue to take it? And if I stop taking it, are there any of these, as you've discussed, latent effects or withdrawal effects or rebound effects or whatever? Because I consider that as things that happen to me when I take this medication. So that's what I want to know. That's what I want to know in kind of plain English.
Thank you, and thank you for the great question to bring it all back together. Is there any other burning question? Because otherwise, doesn't seem so. So then I would like to give 1 minute to each one of you, really just 1 minute, I have this one. You're welcome to step out of your role. So if you have any comments that you want to make out of this discussion, then please do so. I would like to start with our regulatory representative from the Netherlands.
Thank you. So stepping out of the role, I hope it's given you an insight on how difficult it is in practice to do this. And hearing Steve, be amazed if any study could answer all of those questions. And so we are fooling ourselves when we try and say that. So it'd be much better if we said this trial is answering this question, and then there are several unanswered questions that still need to be addressed elsewhere. And maybe that would be, as Anya said, maybe two separate trials here looking at slightly different aspects would be a better thing for the patient, not for the company, because it would delay the time it got on the market, but it might be better for the patient in the long run. I agree, the future patients, I clarify that, not for the person who's sick now, but the one who's sick tomorrow, which is more complicated. My time's probably up.
Thank you. No, you actually still have 8 seconds. Alexander.
So I'm HTA body of Wonderland, and Wonderland because you actually have the possibility to discuss with the HTA body up front before you run the study what your estimate strategy is, which is, I think, usually not the case. And Wonderland for a second reason, because the HTA body knows what estimates they want to have, and they have a very, very clear point of view on that, which also does not necessarily the case yet. Or usually, I think, is not the case yet. So I think it's really, really important for, if you go into these kind of discussions, to be prepared to explain very, very detailed what all the different things are and to train yourself on that. Because otherwise you may end up in a very, very kind of circle discussion where you have different estimates for different endpoints. And, get very confused over time.
Thank you. Steve, over to you.
So in preparing for this, I went to the Indiana University Medical School and talked to people in their lung clinic, a physician and some patients and others who work there, to get some of these perspectives. So I was trying to reflect them faithfully. When I stepped back and looked at the comments that I got from the patients and summarized to prepare for this, they live in the conditional world. If I take this drug, if I have an adverse event, it doesn't work for me, right? And they don't care about the unconditional ITT, what happens overall in everything when you mush it all together, right? So that's one thing. The second was, at the end of my long conversation with the transplant physician who does lung transplants and COPD and cystic fibrosis patients, I described to him the so-called tripartite estimand. Maybe you know the stuff that Muna, Frank Bretz, and I wrote and published a couple years ago. And I presented that to him. What if we came to you out of every clinical trial with the framework of here's the proportion of patients who discontinue due to adverse events and descriptions of those adverse events? What's the proportion of patients that discontinue due to lack of efficacy, and how long did you have to wait to determine that there was this lack of efficacy? And then if you can take your medication for its described duration, what is the treatment effect for efficacy and safety? He loved it. He loved number one and two. He said, I never get that from pharma companies. And number three, which is not an intent to treat analysis, he said, isn't that what you give me anyway? This kind of if I take the drug? And we said, no, that's not exactly the estimate that shows up in the literature. So anyway.
Thank you, Steve. Yep. Oliver, over to you.
Yeah, thanks. I think one of the main advantages of the estimands framework is that it has allowed this discussion of alternative ways of analysing trials rather than the strict ITT approach. I think the while on treatment estimand has got a little bit lost in some of the discussions, and that's why I wanted to bring it forward today as an important strategy for people to discuss. As Steve said, I think most patients and prescribers don't realise that what the treatment estimate that they're labelled for at the moment is an average of people who've taken a drug and not taken a drug. I'm sure the media doesn't when they present the treatment effects of drugs. The assumption is that's what happens when you actually take the drug. So I think there's an important role, whether it be primary or not, there's an important role for the while on treatment estimand for clinical trials.
Thank you very much, Oliver, and thank you to the whole panel for this very interesting discussion, which I think has highlighted that different stakeholders may very well be interested in different estimates. Thanks for highlighting that. So please join me in thanking the nice panel for the discussion. With that being said, I think it's clear that there will be follow-up discussions on that. Maybe next year we can get the GSK people come to present on their respiratory drugs. So thank you again for joining at this early hour after the gala dinner, and please enjoy the rest of the conference. So thanks again.
The show was created in association with PSI. Thanks for listening. Please visit theeffectivestatistician.com to find the show notes and learn more about our podcast to boost your career as a statistician in the health sector. And don't forget to sign up for the webinar. You can find it at theeffectivestatistician.com/leadershipwebinar. Lots of great things that you need to actually implement what you learned from this episode. So, reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.